Welcome to the Leadership Window Podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Man, I got to tell you, this has become the funnest part of my week, interviewing amazing guests and doing this podcast. I am learning so much, for one thing. It's absolutely incredible. Hard to believe this is already episode 11. We're going to be backing off after this week to about one episode a week. I think I mentioned at the beginning of this that we were going to do probably three episodes a week until we got some content up, and we just had a lot of guests schedule very quickly, and I didn't want those interviews to go, you know, 8 weeks away from their interviews. So we packed a whole bunch of them in, but told you not to get too used to it. So after this week, we're probably going to back up to one or two episodes a week. But right now, what a great guest we have today. We have Dr. Tom Klaus, who I met just a few months ago, back at the beginning of this whole wonderful pandemic that we're all living in. And I said, wow, when I get this podcast going, this is exactly the kind of conversation that I wanted to have. So much. We've got a few things in common. We've also got some great differences, I think, in philosophies on certain things. Probably lean a little bit differently politically, which I think is just awesome and amazing when it's someone like Tom, because you just have meaningful conversations. And I just, boy, the minute I met him and started talking to him, I said, this is a guy I want to spend some time around. Dr. Klaus is a Maryland-based nonprofit consultant. He's also a speaker, trainer, writer. He is president of his consulting business. I love this name, Tenacious Change. Going to get Tom to tell us a little bit about that name here in a little bit. But the mission of Tenacious Change is to animate and equip people, organizations, and communities to lead change for the greater good. If that doesn't sound just amazing. In addition to his consulting practice, he's a thought leader with Tamarack Institute, which is a Canadian social change organization. And he's an adjunct professor at Eastern University in Philadelphia in the PhD in organizational leadership programs. Tom specialized, you're going to bear with me here as I read this, because you're going to find out this is why I wanted him on this program. He specializes in leadership, program, and organizational development, as well as research and evaluation. His clients are local, they're statewide, they're regional, they're national, they're even international. He has extensive experience with community engagement and change, organizational leadership and change, intractable controversy management, can't wait for him to define that for us, nonprofit board development and strategy planning, which is a space that he and I share, and the management of government-funded health and human services grants and projects that are national in scope. He's got degrees from William Penn, from Drake University in Iowa, and his PhD in organizational leadership, specializing in nonprofit, from Eastern University in Philadelphia. Tom, thank you for carving out time for this program, and welcome. It's great to connect again.
Likewise, Patrick. But wait a minute. Are you sure you got the right guy?
I think so.
I'm not so sure.
I think so. Get him on the line if I don't have him.
Who wrote that introduction?
He's anyway. Someone I want to talk to.
Okay.
Maybe his mom wrote this. I don't know.
I'm so looking forward to this. So thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, me too. Well, I said in the beginning how much fun I'm having with this podcast, mm-hmm. as you might imagine. And I know you've talked with me about the potential for doing some similar things on your end. You've got, I don't know where you're going to ever find time for it with your 25-hour workday. But I've been looking forward to this conversation. And as you might imagine, and as our listeners might imagine, I've got some great questions for you. But I'd like to start Tell us a little bit about Tenacious Change. And I read the mission, but I'd love to know where the name comes from. Tenacious Change. I love it. It might be one of my favorite names of organizations I've ever heard. How'd this come about, and tie it maybe to your leadership journey and how you've come to this place?
Well, so let me back up just a little bit and say that Tenacious Change actually refers to two things. It refers first to the business, which is the LLC that I created in 2013. And that's pretty much what is described in the intro that you did. It also refers to our core, I guess if you want to call it this, a core product, which is called the Tenacious Change Approach. And so that is actually a systems change framework that offers a way for groups to lead change in organizations and in systems, and in fact, in whole communities. And the Tenacious Change Approach actually grew out of my own experience and that of a colleague of mine who is now really nicely retired and enjoying traveling the world when we're not in lockdown, Ed Saunders. Ed was for many years the director of the School of Social Work at the University of Iowa. And we have been partners in research and work, for almost 30 years at this point in time. And Ed and I really were observing this whole phenomenon, how you go about facilitating change within systems, but particularly within communities. And we were working in the field primarily of teen pregnancy prevention. And anytime you're talking about teen pregnancy prevention, by default, you have to talk about adolescence and sex. And that's a highly controversial issue in communities. Mm-hmm. And so when you introduce the topic into many communities, there has to be an adaptation period for a community to become comfortable facing the issue and feeling comfortable addressing the issue. And so that's where we really began to think about, well, how do we get a community from a point where it's like, we don't want to talk about this, we don't want to deal with this, we don't want to face it. How do we get it to the point where they go, okay, yeah, it's all right for us to really be thinking about this? So you refer to the name Tenacious Change. And so one of the things, you know, one of the places that comes from is the idea that change itself occurs over a long period of time. It's not something that happens overnight. It doesn't happen easily. It is something that is really achieved incrementally. And in order for that to happen, we have to just be incredibly tenacious and focused on bringing that change about, whether it's at the organizational level or the system level or the whole community level. We just have to be so incredibly tenacious about it and focused on it. There's one other aspect to it too, and that is that change is not stagnant itself. So we know more than change, and we're actually now on the cusp of what is the next change that has to happen. I mean, that's part of the evolutionary process for organizations and for systems and communities, is that we're never really actually done changing. And that's where the other meaning of tenacious change comes into play as well. The other thing I will say about tenacious change is that we rooted it in not in techniques, but rather in principles. Because as a systems change framework, working with very complex systems, we felt it was really important to say these are kind of the broad operating principles that need to be in play for inclusive and broad-based and collective change to occur. But those principles are going to be focused on accomplishing certain tasks, but exactly how you do those tasks, we're going to be less prescriptive about that. We just want you to keep before you, these are the principles and these are the tasks, and we're going to help you accomplish those. So we've got 10 principles, 10 tasks, and we're actually seeing some really great uptake of the Tenacious Change Approach just even in the last 3 years It's been very, very exciting. So,
wow. Oh, okay. So I'm sitting here like with now 20 new questions. I know we don't
none of which I'm sure I prepared for.
Yeah, probably fine. Not. Well, I'm not prepared to ask them all either, but boy, you sure open up. You sure open up a lot of thought with this. You said the phrase a minute ago, bringing change about. And it struck me that I wonder from your experience how much work you find yourself doing with your clients on creating change versus responding and reacting to change. A lot of the people that I work with, and COVID-19 and all that's going on this year is a great example of this, right? We're having to manage change. There's change management. How am I adjusting, adapting, responding, reacting, whatever you want to call it? We have to be good at that because change happens to us and around us. But then there's the aspect of leadership where we have to be the initiators of change if we're going to thrive and be relevant and continue to grow in those things. Do you, off the top of your head, where would you find people leaning more in terms of the challenge and the difficulty? Is it in the responding to change piece? Is it in the creating change piece? And what of your 10 principles or whatever your framework is applies to maybe both?
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me begin with the first part of that question. Leadership is something that always happens in a context. And there is a debate in the leadership world, there's many debates in the leadership world, but one of those debates has been around, is the leadership context formed by the environment mm-hmm. in which leadership takes place? Or is it the result of the actions mm-hmm. of individual participants, including leaders within that environment? And probably, you know, when all of the debate and the discussion is done, what it really boils down to is it's actually both.
Yep.
That the leadership, there is a context and of leadership, and usually it is that larger environment in which the organization or the group is trying to function, in which the leader is functioning as a leader within that group. And so there has to be that element of response. You can't control that environment. You cannot control that context. So you have to be able to be responsive to that. The flip side of that is that your actions as a leader, the things that you decide to do, how you interpret that context and form kind of one of the things, one of the most important things that the leaders do is they're engaged in meaning making. So they look in all of the information that's coming at them from the context and in which they're working, and they try to make sense of that and then interpret that back to their followers in a way that says, okay, based upon what I'm seeing here, what we're seeing here, here's more the prescription of what we need to be doing. And those are the actions of leadership, you know, based upon what I'm seeing, here's what I think are going to be really good actions that we take to get us through the situation. Well, just simply taking those actions then does have an effect on the context, whether for good or for ill. I mean, we all know that we have tried something and it just completely blew up in our face and it didn't work very well. And on the other hand, every now and then we get lucky and we try something and it goes really great. So there has to be this willingness of the leadership to be responsive to the context, as well as to be willing to engage with that, to make sense of it, and to try some things to use a football metaphor, since we're in that season, to move the ball on down the field.
Yeah. Let me interject there because, meaning making, when we met a number of months ago, it was, for our listeners' sake, it was a gathering of, I think, about five of us, in the nonprofit consulting and coaching space, a lot of us here in South Carolina, but because of your relationship and your work and partnership with 1000 Feathers and Forrest Alton, who we've had on this show already as well, brought you into this conversation. And we did a series of blogs on leading in crisis. And really, it wasn't any great, huge, you know, academic wisdom. It was more of, hey, here's some things to be thinking about right. as you panic, right? Just calm down, breathe. Here are some questions to ask yourself and things to think about. And that's when you introduced us to the term sense making. I had not heard it in that framework. And I wouldn't say it is synonymous with vision, but it made me think of vision, and you connected it to vision for me, which is, visions, for so many leaders, people think that vision is that big, you know, here's the big ultimate goal, where, you know, the vision statement, vision casting is this big aspirational ethereal place we're going. To me, vision is daily. Vision is in small moments. I call them little visions. And what you describe as sense making, I see a lot as that micro vision casting, which is simply helping people see in front of themselves. And sometimes behind themselves and around themselves, but helping people see. So bringing clarity to chaos,
right,
is to me a sort of a component of vision. And I think it's what you are also relating as sense making. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the connection I'm seeing, is that your sense making construct, which I love, is very related to what I call vision on a daily basis.
I think you're right, Patrick. I appreciate that explanation of that, because when I first heard you talking about that a few months ago, you know, my mind went immediately to that larger vision piece. And so when you're talking about these daily micro visions, that makes sense. Let me give you another way to think about this too, and that is that there's a how sense making works is that a leader is continuously trying to form a description about what's happening with, at least within their mind. They are developing a mental model or a mental description of what is taking place that is impacting the organization or the system or the group that they're trying to lead. And then the counterpart part to that is the proscriptive piece, in which they have settled upon, this is the description, this is how I understand this, I've made sense of this as far as I can. Now, based on that, here's what I think we need to do. And they take that more proscriptive description of what is happening, or prescriptive solution, if you will, to followers, and saying, here's what I think we need to try based upon this. Now, leaders can do that all by themselves, or which frankly, way too many leaders try to do, is that they try to do the sense making all by themselves and shutting out every other voice that is around them. I would rather see them take a much more collaborative or shared leadership approach. But you can do it by yourself, and then, but you can do it as a collaboration, and then you take it forward to your followers and you say, okay, this is where I think we should go. But you're prepared at that point in time to actually, you know, still adapt further, because your followers may say, well, that's a great idea, but, you know, how about this? And there may be some adaptation that takes place. Something you said, and this is not meant to be a tangent, but it is tangential perhaps to what we've been talking about. I was in a conversation earlier this week with my friend and colleague, Liz Weaver, who's the co-CEO at Tamarack Institute up in Ontario. And Liz and I were talking about this issue of you know, how what we are seeing with clients right now, and it's like we came to the same term at the same time. It's like frozen, you know, that what we're seeing are a lot of frozen clients, and like we don't know what to do. We don't know where to go, because we really need a time horizon to be able to plan. We really need a time horizon to be able to say, okay, here's what we need to do over the next 3 weeks, the next 3 months, the next 6 months.
Yep.
The problem is we don't have a time horizon right now. Mm-hmm. Our time horizon may be 3 hours. It may be 3 days. It may be 3 months. It may be 3 years, but we don't know. And so the response that we're seeing from a lot of folks is that they just freeze and that they remain frozen. And I guess part of what I want to say to them is relative to the sense making is that, you know, it's okay that you make sense of what's happening in this moment and you formulate a way to go forward with the understanding that that may change. That doesn't make you a bad leader. It makes you a very good leader, in fact.
Right.
Because you're interpreting what's going on right now and you're coming up with the best formulation of how you need to move forward. Are you going to make a mistake? Absolutely. Are you going to go down the wrong road? Absolutely. But, you know, here's the thing. This is a road nobody in our lifetime has been down before. And so, you know, as long as you're not putting lives at risk, you know, I obviously I don't want a doctor to hear this and say, oh, hey, I've got this idea for a vaccine. Then, you know, Tom, would you like to try this thing? Yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, let's do a little bit of testing on that puppy before I inject it, have it injected in me. But do you see what I'm saying here, Patrick?
I do, yeah.
That we need to give ourselves permission to move, even if we aren't sure.
Totally agree. And I think we're even more on the same page after hearing you say that. You use the word horizon. I often refer to the term horizon vision. And I don't, and again, I call that whatever the horizon is at the moment. So again, the challenge that I find with so many leaders is, well, I'm not good at vision casting. Well, it's probably because you haven't really totally defined what vision casting is. What's right in front of you? What's on the horizon that you can help people see? You know, how can we, if we changed this spreadsheet formula, how will that make our finance committee meetings on our board more efficient and more engaging? Right? That's vision casting, believe it or not. Yeah. So I think that's correct. And I also think, and we talked about this during our blog writing during the early days of COVID, is that what people fear the most is the unknown.
Yes.
And so if you can, if a leader can even make sense, or again, to apply my somewhat synonymous aspect of vision, somehow help people see even if it's the next step and why we're going to take this next step.
That's
just
right.
That is very, very powerful and needed on teams. And what you call frozen, I've been calling paralysis. It's the same thing. Right. We don't know what to do. I was talking earlier today with a potential client who is wondering right now, what do we do about strategic planning? Like, is now the time? We don't know. Like, do we reboot our last one? Do we need to wait until this is all over to plan forward? And so you and I and many others are now in the space of helping leaders say, whatever it is you do, it can't be the normal, usual stuff. We do have to think differently right now. This is a time for adaptive leadership, if ever there was a time for adaptive leadership.
Yeah. My first response is, to folks, I was, when we went into lockdown on March 17th, right? I mean, when the national emergency was called, I was sitting in Jackson, Mississippi, doing a strategy plan with a group there. You talk about just weird timing, you know, but these days when people, and I just recently had this experience with a group that contacted me, and I just said, well, tell me, why do you really want to do a strategic plan right now when you have no idea what the future holds? And they didn't have an answer to that question. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much
because it's been 3 years. It's time, right?
Yeah, right. Because
our calendar says it's due.
We have too much dust on the one sitting on the shelves now.
That's right.
We don't want to clean it. So we just want to do a new one.
The new board chair wants one.
Yeah. And it's like, well, I have no problem moving forward with the strategy planning with them if they can give a compelling reason as to why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some people can, but I have yet to run into a client that wants to do a strategic plan that can really give a cohesive reason why that's a good idea right now.
Yeah.
And instead, I think, I mean, part of it may be, Patrick, because it feels so comfortable to people. We know how to do that.
That's good.
Right. As opposed to what is not comfortable to people is how to be nimble.
Mm-hmm.
How to adapt, how to be resilient,
well,
how to change.
Yeah. One of the things I always say is that strategy is not an event anyway.
Right.
It's ongoing. So whether we say we're going to pause right now and do this 5-year strategic plan like we always do it, that might be ill-advised. But right. We do have to think strategically right now.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so strategy is ongoing, and thinking strategically, and I would submit planning strategically, never ends. And yep. Even after you build a strategic plan, you don't stop strategically planning and thinking and adapting. It's the old, I don't know, was it Eisenhower or MacArthur or whatever that said something like planning is essential, but plans are useless. Something like yeah. Once the yeah. battle starts, things are going to change. So
yeah.
You've got to bring the generals back together and put the tent up and get in the battlefield and pull the map out and say, where are we going next? This didn't work, or this is working. Let's apply more of this. So it's really constant anyway.
Well, you know, so I'm going to try something here. This just came kind of shot into my head, and I'm realizing I'm saying, you know, folks, every now and then you just need to move, even though you feel frozen. So this is going to be a movement on my part because I've not tested this analogy, and so it may drop completely dead right on the spot. But I'm thinking, you know, we are doing strategy planning all of the time mm-hmm. in our individual lives. Right now, where I live, we live in a county in Maryland that has had more deaths related to COVID-19 than many states. And we are still in stage two. And we are effectively, you know, we're at home or we're at home. That's it. We go out every 2 weeks to buy groceries. That's it. Every 2 weeks. Now, back in the good old days, we didn't have to be strategic about grocery shopping because, hey, Shoppers is half a mile from our house. We need something, you know, I buzz down and I pick it up, right? But now we have to be very strategic about our shopping because we know that whatever we get, it's going to have to do us for the next 2 weeks. And so we are actually doing a lot of strategy planning in our personal lives. We need to be able to make the leap to doing that in our organizations as well. It's okay
good.
To do that even with our organizations. Maybe we can't plan for the next 6 months, but we can have a plan for the next month, and it may be a very simple plan. But we can be thinking out 30 days or 2 weeks, whatever it takes to just simply help us get through that period. And I would rather see leaders and organizations invest their time into doing that kind of strategy than worrying about doing a 5-year strategic plan. We don't know what 5 years from now is going to look like. We never did, but right now we really don't know.
Yeah, we don't know what 5 hours is going to look like right now.
Well, I hope I'm watching Netflix in 5 hours. I just.
I see nothing wrong with that analogy. I think it's fit. In fact, I think you could really carry it out. I mean, we're thinking about schooling for our children and family visits and how we're going to fight cabin fever and how we're going to get exercise and how we're going to try to live normal, you know, mm-hmm. in this. So I think you're right. We're being forced to think strategically about our households,
yeah.
our families, our relationships, friendships, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really some of the same tenets. I think that's a good analogy.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that worked.
Well, it worked for me and,
oh, good.
And I'm the one who counts. It's my podcast.
Excellent.
So something else you said a little bit ago, well, we were talking about, you know, create change or respond to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think in either case, so let me run this by you and get your thoughts. This podcast is called The Leadership Window. Mm-hmm. And as frequently as I can, I want to remind our listeners where that comes from. It comes from our definition of leadership, and there are many really good ones. Our definition of leadership is that leadership is a window of opportunity during which vision, inspiration, and empowerment converge to propel people toward a shared goal. I know it's a long definition. It's more of a framework really than a definition, mm-hmm. but the main point I want to make here is that leadership is a window of opportunity, meaning we're not constantly in some act of leadership. Leadership happens in moments, and whether or not we seize those moments is up to us as leaders. So some of those windows of opportunity, we literally have to create. We have a moment, for example, where we can be innovative and take initiative and, you know, champion some idea or path forward, or we might have a window of opportunity to respond in chaos, to step into a role of leadership when people need it most. So whether or not, and I was testing my definition as you were talking about how the context of leadership, situational leadership, I think is a term in the academic world that talks about this. But when you were talking about responding to versus creating, I feel like our definition holds up under that, because in either case, there are windows of opportunity for you to lead or fail to lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. A couple things I might add to that for your consideration. Mm. One is that I also conceive of, let me give you my long definition of leadership.
Please.
When I think about leadership, I think about effective leadership as being a virtuous leadership that adapts, and that's like the windows, right, to the current reality of the leadership moment to inspire, influence, and join with others to achieve a shared goal for the common good. Now, that is the definition I came up with about 10 years ago.
Very close.
And it is very similar to the one, it actually really is what the definition that I work off of today. But I think there is one thing that may be a little bit different that I would highlight, and that is this concept of virtuous leadership. Because virtue is really a state. And it's more than just you don't just activate it at an opportunity or when there is to use your terminology, the window of opportunity for leadership. It is a state of being of one's character, and I think for me that's a really important piece of this. Because there's a wonderful theorist and writer out there by the name of Joanne, and I always slaughter her last name. And if she ever listens to this, I just want to say I sincerely apologize. it's Joanne Chula, and she says the morally virtuous leader will always be a competent leader because he or she will do what is required in the job the right way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think that there is a sense of you know, I'm going to feel a lot better about a leader stepping into that window of leadership if they are of a character that is virtuous. And what I look to in terms of the virtuous character is really, it's very Aristotelian in its understanding of virtue. The other thing that your definition prompted me to think about too here, and I would say that this is not something that only really fairly recently have I begun to really think more and more about as I have done more with this concept of shared or collaborative leadership, and that is the role of the follower in leadership. And I'm really indebted to a guy by the name of Ira Chalif, who wrote a book entitled The Courageous Follower. And I met Ira probably 11 years ago now at the Global Conference of the International Leadership. And I want to say that was at a meeting in either Boston or London. I don't remember for sure. Well, over the years, I've connected and reconnected with Ira, and he provided me the opportunity to really sit under him in his training and his thinking about courageous followership. And I've really incorporated a lot of that into the work I do. And it's an incredible it's an incredible concept. And the idea is that none of us are always just leaders or always just followers. And followership is not a personality trait. It's not something that is within our nature. It has to do with the role that we are in that moment in a group or an organization. So when you think of like a hierarchy, right? We always think of everybody above us as being a leader. And what we fail to recognize is that not only are they a leader, but they're a follower of somebody else. There's always somebody else above them. And so followership becomes really, really important as a part of leadership, that when we are leading well, we are also really attuned to what it means to be a follower and therefore how to engage with the followers that are leading that we are leading at that moment in that particular role.
I love that. And it reminds me that leadership is not a position. Mm-hmm. So there is a hierarchy in organizations and things, right? There's there's people who have ultimate decision-making responsibility and thing, but you know, like you said, everyone has someone above them. I would even say we have people sometimes beside us or below us on the org chart that we follow. And yes. It's not right. Always following a hierarchy necessarily, because leadership is about influence, and influence can happen from any chair. And what I like about what you said too is we do see this organizationally, where nonprofits who want to and feel obligated to be the leader on an issue in their community, they mm-hmm. often come to this revelation that there are times when that is appropriate. There are also times when it's appropriate for us to let someone else take a lead role somewhere, and we're at the table, and we're that follower. So I think that applies individually and organizationally, this concept you're talking about followership. I love that.
I think one of the most brilliant pieces of Ira's work on this that I really, really love are the complementary skills of leaders and followers. Mm-hmm. And I, in fact, I just finished a training on this for a public agency up in New York. And it was in the midst of doing that I really had a pretty powerful aha moment around this particular piece. But it's this idea that there's these complementary skills on the part of the leader or on the part of the follower. The primary skill that they need to master is how do you speak truth to power? And for the leader, the primary skill that they need to master is how do you create the conditions so it's not necessary for followers to speak truth to power?
Yeah.
And that was like this light, you know, I've worked with that material for really quite a while now, but that just absolutely jumped out at me that, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, if I'm leading effectively, then what I want to do is I don't want to make it hard for my followers to come to me and say, hey, Tom, we've got something here we need to pay attention to. I mean, because that's how people die. If I'm the pilot, the captain of an airliner, and I have intimidated my co-pilot so much that my co-pilot's not going to tell me that, oh, by the way, we have a fuel leak and all the fuel is running out and we're over the middle of the Pacific Ocean. That's not good. You know, right. I want that follower to be able to speak up to me. And if I'm the follower in that relationship, I want to feel confident and competent and comfortable enough to be able to say to the captain, hey, you know what? We got a problem. It just developed. We need to address it. And those are just wonderful complementary skills. And I have appreciated so much Ira's contribution to the leadership field by he's actually created now the subfield of followership within leadership. And it's absolutely amazing.
Oh, that's great. That is really good. I want to slightly change topics here on something, another term you used early on in this conversation, systems change. Mm-hmm. I hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. Organizations are putting it on their strategic plans. We want to be about systems change.
Yeah.
And not all that long ago, I finally learned to start asking these organizations, please tell me what that means.
Yeah.
And the discovery that most of them could not tell me what it means.
Yeah.
It's a buzzword.
Yeah.
It's, we all understand it maybe at a very conceptual level. Some people mm-hmm. call it, well, it means we're trying to get to the root causes, or it means we're trying to go upstream, or it means that we're trying to collaborate with others.
Yeah.
But each organization is working with maybe a different system. There's a great book out last year, as a matter of fact, by someone who's got a lot of other work out there too. I'm sure you came across in your studies, Alner Ibrahim, who wrote this book, and I think the name of it is Creating Social Change. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, we've already referred to it a number of times on this podcast, because it just, it fits to so many things. But he talks about the niche organization, like a homeless shelter. Their mm-hmm. only job is get you shelter tonight. Our job is somebody needs a bed to sleep in tonight. We get it for them. We're not tracking them long term, trying to, you know, see if they become, you know, improved in their lives down the road. Or maybe it's a soup kitchen, and our job is just, if you're hungry and you can't afford lunch somewhere, stop by. We'll give you a free lunch. Very niche, very, you know, the output is the outcome. Yeah. But then you have these integrated strategy organizations, like the organization that's trying to prepare young people for life. That's their mission. And what they do is they apply 5 different programs or strategies on that. They deal with the leadership aspect. They deal with the academic aspect, the socioeconomic, and they throw a number of strategies at it. And then you have what Ibrahim calls the ecosystems organization. And that's the one who knows that what it's trying to solve, it is only a piece of the machine. It is a part of a system, and that systems leadership, I'm really loving now this followership concept, because it's a complementary thing that happens within a system, but that the system is going to end homelessness. The system is going to prepare kids for kindergarten better. The system is going to help us steward our environment more effectively, not a single organization. And so my question for you, it's a long question, but I wanted to set it up. When you talk about systems change and your leadership model for systems change and helping people think, how do you help them conceptually frame out what that even means? And is there a universal meaning for systems change that you promote? Or do you find that systems change truly should mean something a little differently for each leadership entity that's working on it?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, so that's a small question.
Oh, no, it's, I know. Yeah. How do you, I know.
All right.
What's the meaning of life? Take that one instead.
Oh my goodness. Well, so systems change, is actually a subfield I guess you would say the grandmother field is systems theory. And so within systems theory, you have theory and models related to systems thinking, which is a subfield mm-hmm. of systems theory. You have theory around complex systems. You have theory on complex adaptive systems. And then you have systems change, which is really as a subfield is only about a decade or so old at this point in time. And it actually comes out of a lot of that a lot of the thinking that has been evolving around moving away from seeing individual components of an issue to seeing the whole of what is impacting that problem. So let me give you an example of that, and from an area that I've worked in for quite a long time in my life, and that is teen pregnancy prevention. Mm-hmm. So the way that we used to see teen pregnancy was that, oh well, you know, if we teach kids sexual pressure refusal skills, that'll take care of the problem. Or if we teach them self-esteem, that will take care of the problem. Or if we teach them how to use condoms or how to access birth control, that will take care of the problem, right? And those are our individual components that are part of the larger system that has grown up around creating the environment and the context, the conditions in which adolescents end up finding themselves with an unplanned pregnancy. Well, what we have come to understand now is that teen pregnancy is impacted by many, many things that have some of which translate to individual behavioral choices that are made by young people that are not to their benefit. But many of those things are things like, do they get good information about their bodies and their sexual health? Do they, what's our health system like? What's our educational system like in terms of what is teaching young people around relationships and around sex? What are the support systems that are in place for a young person if they do experience an unplanned pregnancy? So what we're finding, what we know now is that when we talk about teen pregnancy, we have to see not just the fact that a young person is getting pregnant, but we have to see what are the forces that are at play that are creating the conditions for that pregnancy to incur. One of them that is absolutely huge is poverty. That there's a high correlation between young people living in poverty and the opportunities that they are not able to access because of their socioeconomic condition or situation that many times end up playing out in terms of teen pregnancy. So we are understanding teen pregnancy now as a problem of a system and not just individual behavior. And so when we talk about system change, what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify what are the levers within a system that by pushing or pulling on those levers, we can begin to change. And my philosophy here on this is around the structure. How can we begin to restructure that system so that it changes the behavior of the system or the function of the system? And many times that's what system change tries to do, is to change the structure of the system so that it functions differently and as a result produces a different or better outcome around the issue that the system is addressing. So when I think about systems change and how we try to apply that, is that first we want to understand to the best of our ability what's the system that the issue that we're working on functions within. So we had a large system change initiative in Florida that was around behavioral health. So we needed to understand as much as we could about what the current state of the system was. And then we had to begin to look at, well, where are the places that we can begin to introduce some changes to the structure and how they go about doing things that could have a ripple effect? Well, one of the things that we found in that particular structure, which is unfortunately very, very typical of a lot of systems here in the United States, is that they're very much expert driven and they're siloed. And so, they do a needs assessment in the community and they decide that tells them everything they need to know. And they act on that needs assessment without really striving for a deeper community understanding of all the dynamics of the issue. And then the orders come down from on top and they're trying to apply the changes to address the problem. And we find that occasionally that works, but many times it leaves behind the people that are really most affected by the issue. So in this particular case, what we saw was a lot of siloing. We saw a lot of expert-driven solutions for behavioral health. So the intervention that we did was actually quite simple and quite elegant in its simplicity, in that we created an entirely different way of thinking and approaching the problem, which was extremely collaboratively working with with the people in the community that were most affected by the issue. And so we brought them together in a couple of summits. We started by bringing them together in a couple of summits. One of the silly little things we did is that nobody was allowed to attend the summit and use a title. So you didn't know if you were sitting next to the director of public health, somebody from the mayor's office, the chief of police, or somebody who was being treated for bipolar disorder, because we had a broad mixture of people that were in that group, and the relationships that formed coming out of that were really good, and the structures that began to be birthed out of that are structures that have endured even through the pandemic. To continue to look at what are the community solutions that we can bring forward to this issue, and not just the expert solutions. And in that way, you begin to change the system in terms of how behavioral health is being addressed there in that particular part of Florida. So that's an example. And I realize I just really went way on about that.
That's okay. So run that answer by me one more time. No, I'm just kidding. What you're saying is leadership is hard. That's what you're saying. And it is.
It's hard and fun.
A couple of examples came to mind as you were telling that story. One is the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation, I think is the name of the full mm-hmm. institute. Richard Harwood has done a lot of work with United Way, which our listeners know is my background in my mm-hmm. nonprofit world. And he described something very similar when you're addressing community need, and that is to overlay public data on top of expert data, meaning let's get the statistics and the experts that know what the real things are, but let's also get the sentiment and the attitudes and the appetites from the people. And he calls it turning outward. And yes. the other thing that it reminded me of is Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky's work on adaptive leadership versus technical leadership, bringing mm-hmm. technical solutions to a known problem where there is a known solution versus adaptive leadership where you've got to create the solutions together because they haven't been invented yet. And I think the story you just told really blends those two things. It's not one or the other. You actually described, at least I think I heard, elements of both of those applied to that story.
Well, let me give you a couple other terms that might be useful. One is a term that comes from my colleagues in Canada at the Tamarack Institute. They use the term content experts and context experts. And the folks that we worked with in Florida, and that was actually a joint project between myself and the Tamarack Institute, they came up with a slight variation on those terminology. They talked about those people with lived experience and those people with learned experience.
Yeah.
And so there is a balance in there. We have been in the United States here, we have been trying to solve problems that are impacting people using largely content experts or people with learned experience for a very, very long time. And I can tell you, where this really hit me in the face was at a meeting. I won't say the city that this was in, but it was a northeastern city, we'll just say. I was in a meeting in this city in which we had just done a training. And in that meeting, in that training that day, the expectation was that we were supposed to have a group of both context and content experts, or people with lived experience and learned experience. And as we were debriefing that meeting, I found out that everybody that was in that training session, and we were leaving it up to the client to do this recruitment, and we'd been very explicit, and we learned that everybody that was in that training session was a content expert, and not a single one of them actually lived in the community that was being served. And I was aghast, and I said, help me understand why you did not have people here from the community that are actually living with this problem. And one of the people in the meeting started pounding the table. It was the weirdest thing. She is pounding the table, and she says, because we are the experts and not them. And I thought, please do not come to my community and try to help me.
I guess she never read Howard Cosell's book, I Never Played the Game.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what made Cosell great was that he didn't ever play the game, but he surrounded himself with color commentators that had played the game, with Frank Gifford and Don Meredith. And I'm dating myself here, but some, you know, a lot of our listeners will know who those are. But yeah, it reminds me, now you and I share a doctoral journey in organizational leadership in common, although I'm in the middle of mine, you're done with yours.
Thank God.
But yeah, it also applies to, you know, one of the things I learned quickly in this program is, you know, you've definitely learned about research and a background on research, and you learn that the whole scientific method and quantitative analysis to study things is great, but there has been a real rise not all that long ago in more qualitative research, and now into mixed method studies where people are doing a combination of quantitative and qualitative, so that you get the learned experience from the quantitative and you get the lived experience from like a phenomenological study or an ethnographic study, where you really get down deep in whether it's case studies or interviews or whatever, to find out, yeah, but what's this really like for you? what's really going on? What's behind this? What does it create for you? And going back to Harwood, what Harwood taught us in community conversations is not, hey, we did the research and it says that high school graduation rates are low in this community. What do you think about that? Well, we don't think about that. That's not what we think about. That's not what we talk about at our kitchen table. So the question then becomes, well, what are your hopes and fears and aspirations and challenges? And what do you see for our community? So it becomes much more of a blend between, again, the expert data and the public data.
Absolutely. And I'm one of those guys that is very much qualitative. Fortunately for me, I'm married to a woman who is a very high level quantitative researcher. And so
an epidemiologist, if I remember correctly,
an epidemiologist. Uh-huh. And so that's really great. Hey, I got to tell you that it's been really great during COVID-19, except that she doesn't let me go outside. Other than that, it's just absolutely great.
She doesn't let you go outside.
No, it's
I bet she's getting wonderful. Tired of that. She can't wait for this to be over.
I think she's ready to drop me off the deck here at some point. But actually, it's really, you know, for us, that's the best of both worlds, because I do a lot of mixed method evaluation. I don't see my strength as being in quant. Certainly it's my wife's. So she partners with me on a number of those evaluations, and that is really, really great. But I think this idea, though, about needing to go to those people that are most impacted by whatever the issue is that we're trying to address is really, really critical. And that's true even of organizations. You know, one of the projects I'm working in right now is with a public agency, and trying to build it. One of the things I've been trying to do is to build a bridge of collaboration between leadership and frontline workers. And it's made a little bit challenging because there is a union that's in the mix there, right? But what we're finding is that when they actually get in the same room together and they're able to talk with one another and learn together, what they're finding is that there's a change in perception that is occurring, and a new sense of respect and appreciation that is emerging. But it takes some time for that to happen, and you have to be willing to get in there and tell the stories and listen to the stories and get to know one another at that level. And I just tip my hat to them for doing that. It's hard work, but they're doing it.
Yeah. Well, I know we're running low on time here. There are a couple of questions I want to ask you that I ask all my guests. And one of them is, who were the leaders, Tom, in your early career or life that have helped shape your view of leadership? I love your definition of leadership. You've talked a lot about your philosophy around it. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the leaders, maybe one or two of the leaders, that have helped shape that for you, and what made them the leaders that they were?
Yeah. Well, I think one that I would mention would be Ira Chalif, you know, and that's fairly recently, you know, that I've really been working more with Ira on the Courageous Followers piece. But going back in my earliest time, there was a guy by the name, I'm actually not going to use names because I don't have much good to say about one person. But there was one guy.
We learn a lot from those leaders too, by the way. They help us shape our view of leadership.
We sure do. But one guy, what he taught me was the value of relationship building and leadership. And that, so part of my philosophy is really captured, in the idea that, and actually I have a piece that I've done, and it's a graphic that I use, and it basically says it's all about relationships. It's always about relationships, and the process of building relationships is the most important work. And I really think that applies to leadership as well. The degree to which we have a really effective relationship with the people we're trying to lead is the degree to which we're going to be effective as a leader. And then the other person was somebody I worked with early in my career. And basically what I took away from this person was I watched him very carefully, and I found that if I did absolutely the opposite thing from everything I was seeing, it made me a better leader.
You'd probably be a good leader. Yeah.
And so now when I'm in a leadership dilemma and I'm not really sure what to do, I say, what would so-and-so do? Oh, okay, I'm going to do the opposite. And it pretty much usually works out.
You know, it's interesting. I'll go back to your analogy about, you know, comparing leadership to our lives and our households. You know, how many people do we see come out of negative experiences in childhood with parents who were not good parents, we'll just say, and they follow the pattern versus those who decide, I'm not going to be that kind of parent. Yeah. You know,
yeah, that's right.
Leadership is the same way. We either follow the pattern that we see, or we learn from it and say, okay, this is not quite how we'll do leadership. I have a daughter who's fairly new in leadership in the restaurant business, actually the microbrewery business. Mm-hmm. And, she was hired in part because she was able to articulate things in her non-leadership experience of leaders that weren't doing it the way it really probably should be done. So she had this sense about her and they really loved it in the interview. And so it sounds like you've seen enough about how not to do it that you would probably lead it differently. So I really do appreciate that. What would be, to wrap this up, Tom, what is the Dr. Tom Klaus piece of advice for all leaders? What's your like number one piece of advice that you think all leaders should follow?
Well, you know what? So it actually really ties back into what I just said that I learned from that really positive leader, that it's all about relationships. Mm. It's always about relationships. And the process of building relationships is the most important work. And the reason it is that if we want to be really effective leaders, if we want to be really good leaders, we have to learn when to lead alone, when to lead with others, and when to follow. And so that's what I would encourage folks to do is to learn when to lead alone, learn when you need to lead with others, and learn when you need to follow. And the way that we develop the confidence and the trust to do those three things is when we have really high quality relationships with the people that we're trying to provide leadership to. So that's not just one thing. I guess that's about three things.
Is so fantastic. I always say that emotional intelligence is really the most important concept of leadership to get down, more than strategy, more than theory, another time we'll talk about more academic theory and how it applies and how sometimes it doesn't apply just to everyday leadership. We can talk theory all day, but you learn it in the crucible of practicing it.
Yes, you do.
Tom, this was rich, man. I knew it would be. This is why I love this show. You're doing fantastic work.
Thank you, Patrick.
I need to learn more. I need to learn more from you. And just thanks so much for coming on. It's just been amazing. Folks, you see why we do this show. Stay tuned in. We got another episode in a couple of days from someone who is one of those practitioners in leadership, leading community level social change. And how do you bring a bunch of people around that? So stay tuned with us. And in the meantime, lead on.